Blog Talk Radio.
Mojuba Asheda, Mojuba Aluwa Mi, Apolabi Pega, Mojuba Araba Mi, Adesanya Awuyade, Mojuba Ogute Compound Ode Remo, Mojuba Baba, Mojuba Yeye, Mojuba Egun, to all the God children, Mojuba Egun, to all the Babalawos, the Ears, Mojuba Egungun, to all the chiefs, Mojuba Egungun, to all the Awos, Mojuba Egungun, to all those that are listening, who are tuned in. We give praise and thanks to the Most High. We say Ashe, 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 Ashe-o.
Ashe-o. Welcome to Sign of the Times, everyone. This is Queen Tahira. Sign of the Times is brought to you by the UAC, the United African Coalition for Justice and Human Rights. We began the UAC after the unjust Zimmerman verdict of July 2013, and we ask that you please support us and our sponsors. Please support Manhood, Race, and Culture, headed up by my co-host on Wednesday nights, Dr. James Jones. You can find him on Facebook as James Jones, as well as Manhood, Race, Culture as a group and like page, and on the World Wide Web at manhoodraceculture.com. Also, please support Arlie Gordon. Find him on Facebook as Arlie Gordon and Unity Designs, as well as on the World Wide Web at unitydesign.com. And Unity is spelled U-N-I-T-E-E. And, of course, we never want to forget our brothers and sisters who are behind enemy lines. We ask that you please support Unheard Voices, the Free Alabama Movement, and the Free Ohio Movement on Facebook, respectively, as well as on the World Wide Web at freealabamamovement.com and freeohiomovement.org. We also want to remind you quickly to please consider making a $10 monthly commitment to Sign of the Times so that we can continue to expand not only our programming, but be able to come to potentially your city to see what's going on in your neighborhood and continue to make the connections that we have for the past almost 4 years here on the air. So we desire to be able to do that, and in order to do that, we must have resources. So please consider making a contribution via our PayPal account. And you can do that via our email at signothetimes19@gmail.com, sign the letter O, thetimes1919@gmail.com, as well as U.S. Postal Mail, and our mailing address is 1623 Dalton Street, D-A-L-T-O-N Street, number 14939, Cincinnati, Ohio, 45250. Again, 1623 Dalton, D-A-L-T-O-N, number 14939, Cincinnati, Ohio, 45250. And so, as always, we love you and we appreciate you for your past and continued support simply as listeners and contributors to the dialogues that we have here on Sign of the Times. So tonight we are honored to have with us Brother Raheem Chavez, and he is here to speak on elementary genocide. Welcome, Brother Raheem. How are you doing this evening?
Thank you. Thank you, sister. I am doing very well. I'm excited, and I want to, you know, bring the message to the people and raise their vibrational pitch.
Ashe, that's good to hear. And I'm excited to have you on the air for a couple of reasons. One, and most of all, I believe in the project that you're working on, and by the fact that you've persevered and turned this into not one, not two, but three. So tell us a little bit about you, and then we'll get into some of the work that you have done and are in the process of completing.
In regards to myself, I'm an award-winning journalist that used to write for several different urban-driven publications, whether it be The Source, Vibe, XXL, Urban Enterprise, and the list goes on and on. Eventually, I made my transition into filmmaking. I worked on several Hollywood films. I did music videos, commercials, web series, and this led me to documentary filmmaking. In 2010, I began to do the research. I put my first documentary out in 2013. That was called Elementary Genocide, the School to Prison Pipeline. After that, came back with Elementary Genocide 2, the Board of Education versus the Board of Incarceration. And now we are Elementary Genocide 3, Academic Holocaust. And this one is going to be the one, it's the last of the documentary series.
Ashe. So for those who may be new to hearing the term elementary genocide, first talk about one where you discuss the school-to-prison pipeline. There are some people who don't believe that there is such a thing as the school-to-prison pipeline. So let's talk about one, and then we'll proceed to talk about two and move forward to three.
It's funny that you say that, because initially when I put out the documentary, people were saying, oh, Raheem, that's an urban legend. No, there's no people sitting in a room making up these numbers and using these numbers. And then the truth came out. So to take it back and to answer your question, the school-to-prison pipeline is essentially where the government and the school system looks at the reading scores of third and fourth graders, and they're able to determine how many prisons they're going to build in the next 10 to 15 years. Because if you're not reading on grade level, by the time you're in the third or fourth grade, there's a 75% chance that you're going to end up in prison. These prisons are sold on the stock market. So that's what we did with one. And then two, the Board of Education versus the Board of Incarceration, we went back to the landmark ruling of Brown versus Board of Education, and we asked the proverbial question, has it done more harm than good? And we have learned that it done more harm than good, because over 82,000 teachers was let go. What they did was they integrated students, but they didn't integrate teachers. And at that time, those teachers that was let go was black teachers, the ones that knew how to teach, knew that when we're dealing with education, that we're dealing with intent and content. And intent is what you teach, and content is, intent is how you teach it, and content is what you teach, pardon me. So that happened. So now we at Elementary Genocide 3, Academic Holocaust. This is the last in a three-part series. And what we want to show is that the assassination of your mind, the assassination of your critical thinking, is no different than the murder of the black and brown bodies that is being done all across America by the extrajudicial killing of black and brown people, and that there is a correlation. It starts with the miseducation that begins in the school system, the miseducation of society, the way that we are viewed in the media and different things like that. And then ultimately it leads to the extermination of black and brown people.
Ashe. One of the things that I don't know is a part of a lot of conversations is the fact that our children are being, to a certain extent, used by a system that, as you said, never really intended for them to benefit from it. And because I've experienced a certain amount of this on a personal level with my children here in Cincinnati, I know for a fact that this pipeline is very real. So to have to convince anyone of that is surprising, but only, again, probably because I've experienced it. And as with many things in our community, unless our people actually experience it firsthand, they really have a hard time believing that it exists.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's funny because President Obama, when he was president, he did a State of the Union speech where he mentioned eradicating the school-to-prison pipeline. And when I tell you, my phone went off, my text went off, and people was like, oh, he's talking about your film, which I don't know if he was or if he wasn't, but they first heard of the term school-to-prison pipeline. A lot of people heard it from my film. And to this day, a lot of people think that I coined that terminology. No, I didn't coin it. It existed for the movie. I just was the first one to bring it out publicly. And I think, you know, the reason why the president might have made it, a statement about it is because one of the participants in the documentary, his name is Tracy Syfax, and he was a 2014 Champion of Change winner. He was invited to the White House to meet with Attorney General Holder and President Obama for his initiative on reentry, those that are behind enemy lines and that are coming back to society, which we call them returning citizens. We don't call them ex-felons, we call them returning citizens. So he works with them, and that's why he was invited to the White House. So the film was mentioned on their White House press release, in the press release on their website, and from there it got a lot of traction, and like I said, it's award-winning. We won several awards for one. We won several awards for two. And we hope to do the same thing with three. And we need the masses of people to support this movement, because it's documentaries such as this where the person that's telling the story is an individual that has firsthand knowledge of this, You know, I have been behind enemy lines for 6 years, which was over 17 years ago. So I know in and out of the game, and I know how this plays out, and I was able to overcome it and remain out in the free society, and I'm doing what I'm doing today.
Shay, you definitely are inspiration. Whether people have actually experienced being incarcerated or not, you represent on many levels, Brother Raheem. And, you know, I can say that I'm quite proud to see the progress and see you, you know, work through this and be able to put yourself out there and to a certain extent be vulnerable for on behalf of our people. So, you know, I have a lot of admiration and respect for you for being courageous enough to do that and put yourself out there like that. That's to be commended. And so you mentioned that this is an actual movement. What we, you know, have experienced in the community is that sometimes people will come and you know, they'll make their move and be successful for a little while, but things don't ever really change. So talk about how this is going to evolve into something bigger than the documentary series.
Well, what I like to tell people when they view the documentary is that this is more than a documentary, as you just said. It's a call to action. And many shall come, only a few should be chosen, the ones that are chosen, the ones that are chosen. So it's up to us to bring about the change. You know, we got to create the movement and change. We have to be responsible. And when you look at the word responsibility, you see respond to your ability. All of us have some type of ability. If you're a parent, you need to be proactive in the PTA meetings. You need to eventually get on that school board and start working from change within inside if you have to send your son to a public school. For many of us, our option is to homeschool our kids. A lot of parents are working. They have cooperative homeschooling that you can get involved in, where you can do it as a group thing. Like, we're the only race of people, Malcolm X said this, that allow our open enemy to teach our children. And we have to be mindful. John Henry Clark told us that these are the same people that will have us believe that we are one chromosome away from being farm animals. So it's up to us to start making this change. And the thing about this is that you don't have to ask people for permission. You don't have to march. You don't have to protest. You don't have to do none of that. You just simply have to take the education and put it in your own hand. You know, school doesn't begin at 8 o'clock in the morning when the bell rings, and it doesn't end at 3 p.m. when school is over. School starts at home. And even if you send them to school, when they come back home, you need to re-educate them. You know, education is a lifelong process. Everything that you do has a lesson learned in that. The parents is a child's first teacher. So, therefore, your knowledge, what you teach your kids, will reign supreme over anything that could be learned in school. And education should never be confined to a building or four walls. You can take a child outside, a group of kids outside, and teach them and educate them. And that's how it was when I learned. You know, we learned on the rooftops, the street corner. We learned in the parks. And we got educated during my time coming up.
Ashe, and like you said, the education was communal, which, you know, is something that has been forgotten about, because I think a lot of the generation that we see out here in the streets and protesting have the right type of concept in mind that this system was never designed to have us succeed, and the very same system is the one that resulted in the reasoning for them being in the street. So I think it's a good time period to capture some of that energy. How do you propose that we do that and get the youth involved in helping to support this movement?
Well, I think there's several ways that we can do it, and I think one of the reasons is how we're doing it now, by having this conversation, by having this dialogue, and also by leading by example. I recently have been invited to do Career Day at an elementary school here in Atlanta, and when I agreed to do it, the individual that was asking me was so excited. I said, "Raheem, you don't know how much this means to me." And I said, "Oh, don't worry about it. It's nothing. This is for the babies. This is for the kids." She was like, "No, you really don't understand how hard it is to get people to come in to these kids for Career Day." And I was like, "Wow, you serious?" So we can't just say we're about the upliftment of the babies and the youth for the future if we don't go out and engage them and show them this positive role model that exists. And I go around the country. I do morning screenings. I talk to the youth, and I use my story, my life, as a cautionary tale to show them that you can get a second chance in life. You have to be able to own up to your mistakes or whatever circumstances you may be in and take charge of your life. You know, we got to be phenomenal or we're going to be forgotten. And I refuse to be forgotten. When I was growing up, though I made mistakes, I was always well read. I read books from Marcus Garvey, Elijah Muhammad, and the list goes on and on. And one of the key things that always stuck with me was a quote from Marcus Garvey, where he said, "Intelligence rules the world and ignorance carries the burden." I never wanted to be a burden for my people, so I educated myself. I got a college degree, and I never used a college degree. I didn't have to. I was smart enough to come out and be an entrepreneur. So for the last 14 years, I've been working for myself. I've been hiring people, and I've been giving back to my community. And that's what education is about. You know, even if I used my degree and I was making a lot of money every year, if it's not benefiting my community, then it's really not doing anything. And that's what your education should be able to do. It should be able to sustain your livelihood, give back to the community, and have you exist and stand on your truth for square and be righteous.
Ashe. Now, you know, another one of the things that you have spoken on in the documentary is the style, if you will, of how our children learn, and being able to be in an environment that is conducive to how we learn. So can you talk a little bit about the difference in the learning style that exists in these institutions where we faithfully send our children every day versus the type of learning style that would be most beneficial to us?
Well, when we look at the learning style of what's being done in the public school system as opposed to how we was taught and how we learned, there's certain different ways that an individual learns. Some are kinesthetic, some are visual, some are audio. And in the public school system, European education is one style fits all. The teacher teaches one way to 60 students. And that's not how it works. And also, they teach from a left brain lineal aspect and not the right side of the brain, which is the Afrocentric aspect. And when you look at the way that the classroom is formatted, you have rows of seats, and usually the smartest person in the class sits in the front, and the person that's the class clown, so to say, or one that's not really academically challenged is in the back, and that's not how it's taught. In an Afrocentric society and Afrocentric way of teaching, it's in a circle, it's in a cipher, so everyone is on equal footing. So there's a lot of different styles and different ways of teaching. We are rhythmic people. You can use music, you can use song, you can use dance. That's not being done in the school system. In fact, most of the arts programs throughout the United States has been taken out of the school system due to budget constraints.
Yeah, that's exactly right. But you see an increase in all of these programs that are infused, you know, upon our children, and often without any type of parent input and, you know, even training to a certain extent. I know Every Child Succeed. I know that there's a big push for STEM schools now. And not to say that our children don't need those kinds of things academically, but simply because of how they are teaching them. That's why a lot of our children are still failing academically, especially when it comes to the tests and things like that that they force upon our children on an annual basis. So in your vision of a good homeschool network, what would that consist
of? A good homeschool network will consist of children not only learning how to do certain things, but learning what's the benefit of it. So when we in an economy where a lot of individuals are working in service industries and not being taught to be entrepreneurs, we need to teach our kids how to be entrepreneurs. The one main thing that every homeschool should have is an entrepreneur program. You have to find out what is the passion for each student and have that passion turn into where they can it can be viable and they can make money. I think that's the most important thing when we deal with education, that they learn a skill, because in this economy you can always get laid off for a job, you can always get fired, but if you have a skill, you can take that anywhere and you can open up your own business. And I think that's something that definitely needs to be taught in every homeschool. And when I say that you need to find a passion, you know, a lot of our kids want to be musicians. They want to get into the sports arena. They want to be in the NFL or the NBA. And if you have a student that's good in math, well, he's not excelling in math, but he's good in basketball, then you show him that geometry is dealing with basketball, because you have to know rate times time equals distance. And then when he's shooting the ball, he knows that he has to have that formula in his head for it to go in the basket. And then if he's shooting it from the side and that's an angle, then that's geometry. And if you teach from that aspect, a child will learn that because he's interested in basketball. The same thing with music. You know, you have what they call bars and raps, 16 bars. So you got to be able to know how to count the stanzas. You have to know which notes is which. So you can do all of that within the aspect of teaching. Everything can be taught and incorporated into your style of teaching.
Ashe. You know, I have a youth program here in Cincinnati, and I always get the best results from the worst behaved children sometimes, because we challenge them to, you know, think outside of what they've been told they are. And so I think that that's what helps us to accomplish great things with a lot of our children. And it's so easy because of the zero tolerance policies and school resource officer enforcement. Punishment seems to be the order of the day more so than education. So can you talk about some of the things that you found out as you were developing this project that have to do with the differences in how our children are disciplined and some of the things that have an impact on them as they're trying to get their education?
Absolutely. When you talk about zero tolerance and the punishment that is given out, we look at black youth are three times more likely, particularly males, are three times more likely to be suspended than their white counterparts for the same offense. And then when we look at female, it's six more times as likely as their female counterparts. And also, you mentioned resource officers. In New York City alone, there is more resource officers than there is guidance counselors. And New York City has more resource officers in the school system than the entire police force in the District of Columbia and the entire police force in the state of Detroit. So that in itself is not about education. It's about money, and it's about criminalizing these young kids. And in the documentary, you have a judge that's in there. He talks about how neurologists recently discovered that the front lobe of the brain is not fully developed until you're in your mid-20s. So here it is that children are making childish mistakes and, you know, behavior that we might not agree upon, but we did it when we was their age. But now, all of a sudden, they're being criminalized, you know, for making childish mistakes when we know that the front lobe of the brain is not fully developed. The part that deals with reason, the common sense, is not fully developed until they're in their mid-20s. That in itself got to stop. And there is always a racial component to everything. You know, a lot of people don't like to hear that, but this is systematically done to black youth specifically because it has been proven that if we're given an equal chance or the same chance as anybody else, that we excel far more beyond than anybody else. So this is just another way to hold us back. We have to realize that, and we have to take steps to prevent that. You know, growing up, a lot of times we heard the saying that we have to work twice as hard, and today, you could work twice as hard. That's no longer no good. Your skin is your sin. Just by virtue of you being black, there is a systematic plan to hold you back. You know, and when we start talking about race and inequality, and, you know, a lot of people always say, oh, it's not everybody. And no, it's not, you know. In fact, it's not even one individual. It's a system. And that's what people got to realize. You know, not to change the subject, but what's going on with Bill O'Reilly? People are celebrating that he got fired, and rightfully so, he should be fired. But they just placed the system. I mean, they just placed the individual. The system still exists.
Mm-hmm.
The system that gave him that platform still exists. The system that put him up until where he is able to earn in excess of over $20 million a year. That system exists, and there's someone that's going to come in and that's going to take his place and is going to tote the same line and have the same racist, white supremacist rhetoric. So it's not about individuals. It's about the system. And until that system is destroyed, dismantled, then we're going to continue to have to fight for freedom, justice, and equality.
That's right. And for those who are listening on your phone, if you'd like to come in queue, please push the number 1. And if you're listening on your computer, you can dial in at 917-889-8059. And so, Brother Raheem, you spoke on being behind enemy lines and, again, affirming the fact that the school-to-prison pipeline does exist. People have said that about the prison industry, that it needs to be reformed, but I wholeheartedly agree with your position that this system can't be reformed, that it has to be dismantled, and because of the fact that we have never truly been free as a nation of people, I don't see why we would have a problem with dismantling the system. I know one of the challenges that you had was initially getting people to be a part of a part one because of the existing system, because of repercussions that can come when you speak truth to power. So can you talk a little bit about your position on how this impacts the money, millions and millions of dollars that are being made from the private prison industry, and talk about your position on dismantling that part of the system, because it's all definitely connected.
That was a long question. But
I have a tendency to do that. I apologize.
No, it's cool. From the start of me doing the documentary, I had a lot of individuals that expressed interest that, you know, met with me, and they said that this is definitely a phenomenon that's going on, and whatever they can do to help, then by all means, give them a call. So certain individuals got that call. I want you to appear in it. This is the subject line, and this is what we're going to talk about. And two or three people dropped out. And, you know, all of them truthfully told me, listen, Raheem, I love what you're doing, but I can't be a part of it because I still work for Atlanta Public School System. And rightfully so, I had to understand that because that's their livelihood. And some people are not going to tote the line and be on the front line. And we have to realize the reality of that. They may think of themselves as, you know what, I'll work within the system and try to change it from there. It never works like that. It never works like that. You deviate from the curriculum, from the plan, you ain't going to be there long. And deviating from the curriculum and the plan, it would have been the beginner's documentary. So I understand that. So that's just the first part of that. In regards to the private prison, if you go on the website of GEO or CCA, Correction Corporation of America, they recently changed their name too. I can't recall what the name is, but, you know, they start when Obama said that he wasn't renewing the contracts for federal prisons, and they caught a lot of backlash, and their stocks went down, they changed their name. Same players, different name. But on their website, they said, if we build it, they will come. That's their model. They know that. All they have to do is just build it up. And what they did was they had a letter that they sent out to each state. And basically what they was telling them is that we can run your prisons at a fraction of the price that you're running it for if you let us run it. In order to sign this contract, you have to guarantee that you will maintain a 90% occupancy rate. So if you can't fill your prison cells up to 90%, then essentially what happens is that you are contract, you're in void of your contract, rather, and they can sue you and they can ask for the money of the loss. You know, so when you have a situation like that, breach of contract, that's the word I was looking for. If you have a situation like that where a state has to maintain 90% occupancy rate, what they're going to do is arbitrarily start locking folks up. Where you see the recent video of the guy jaywalking in the middle of the street. Police body slam him, beat him up, take him to jail, he's resisting arrest. And little low-level crimes, spitting on a sidewalk, urinating in the street, you know, crimes where there is no real victim. Arrest for low-level arrest for marijuana, which is now legal in certain states, and that's another story because everybody else is making money off of it, but you still have people that's languished in jail for 10, 20 years, but now people can sell it and profit off of it, and most of the people that's doing it don't look like you and I. So when you see all of that, you know that there's a profit motive behind it. So the prison system are making money. These private corporations is making money. And the solution is coming out of certain states. In Oregon, what they did was they was able to get the entire state of Oregon to divest all their money out of Wells Fargo, out of any corporation that has ties to the school-to-prison pipeline. The school system, and not the school system, the college and universities In California, they was able to do it. Columbia University, they take the teachers' retirement money and certain pensions and things like that, and that is invested in companies that runs the prison. And a lot of these school board members, they have investments in the private prison company. So they have a vested interest in supporting this corporation. So these states, certain schools, divested millions and millions of dollars out of the private, and that's what needs to be done. Almost similar to the situation when it was South Africa and the apartheid movement. That didn't stop until companies start divesting out of Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And it's always, whenever there's a problem, you always follow the money. And you'll be surprised who sits on these boards, who has invested interest, who's legislating these laws, what's the reason behind these laws. A lot of these legislators, you could, it's public information who holds stock in these companies. And you'll find out the same person that's pushing these laws and rallying for these laws and legislation to get passed has a vested interest in this company because he has stocks in it. So we're fighting against wickedness in high places.
Mm-hmm. I say. We definitely are. And you mentioned, and I just want to remind listeners, if you're listening on your phone, push one to come into queue. We have people who sit on a lot of these school boards who look just like us. We have mayors in major cities that look just like us. We have police chiefs in places that look just like us. But yet there hasn't been a lot of accountability made for the fact that there's not a lot of progress being made. There's very little, if any, real progress being made. It's going to be long-lasting. You know, progress is no good unless it has a lasting impact in our community, in which we do not see that. So the first part of my question is, how do we begin to hold those who are in these positions of trust more accountable, and how can we give our parents and our community leaders more courage so that the fear of that repercussion doesn't outweigh the long-term benefit that it could have on the community?
I think that we have to realize just because a person might bear the same skin complexion as us, that don't mean he's on our side and that he's our friend, he's our ally. He can be a low-frequency slave that is doing the work of our open enemy, and he has a hidden agenda because he's a coon, and they pay coons well. That's as simple as I can put it. But when we do put individuals in position of power, we have to be mindful that these are human beings and that they're subject to error, and a lot of them are not there wholeheartedly to represent us. And when we realize that, if that happens, we need to hold a foot to the fire. And if it's a mayor, they need to be a one-term mayor. And we need to hold them accountable. And a lot of times we don't do that, and we give them passes because we don't want to seem like, you know, we tearing down our own brother or we tearing down our own sister. But if you start making examples of these individuals, they will cease to exist. And another thing we have to do, if we're going to play the politics, you know, in politics, it's about money. So what we have to do is we have to pool our resources together and get behind a candidate, because there are candidates that are running for some of these offices that are genuine, revolutionary, firebrand people, but they are not backed by big corporations. They are not backed by big donors because they're on the side of the people. But if we were to come up with 300, if it's a small mayor campaign, and you know the person that's leading, he has a $300,000 budget, a $300,000 budget, then we need to match that with $500,000 for the person that we try to put in office. And that is not being done. So if we groom young individuals and get them in office and as a community put our money behind them, then we won't have these handkerchief head Negroes occupying office space. We have those that are on the right side of history. Now, for example, in Ferguson, you had this racist white mayor that said race had nothing to do with the killing of Michael Brown. And he was recently reelected. I don't understand how that could be done, because during that Ferguson situation, you had community activists, you had leaders, veterans in the civil rights struggle that went down there, that was holding political education classes, voters registration, and different things like that. And it was a sister. Her name was Anita Jones, I want to say. But she was a sister. She was going up against the mayor, and she lost by 500 votes. And they say 2,000 people actually voted in that election. So I said to myself, if all those people that was in the street, that was residents of Ferguson, that was mad and upset at this mayor, if all of those people would have came out and voted for this sister, she would have been in office. We didn't vote. You know, our people, we didn't come out and vote. So now he gets a second term. I don't understand how that could happen. It is a city that's predominantly black, had one police officer on the force, one black police officer on the force. The school board had one black person on the school board. And the city is predominantly black. You know, y'all not electing people to school boards. You know, y'all elected a mayor that's nothing but an overseer. And sometimes, you know, situations where, you know, I'm not too big on politics, but there's certain situations on local levels where we could make changes, and our people drop the ball. You know, our people drop the ball. So we got to continue to fight. You know, we got to continue to fight. Like, I don't understand. Like, if you see that this man is not on the right side of history, how does he get a second chance? They don't give us a second chance. You know, in life sometimes you don't get a second chance, but he was able to get a second chance. So he's gonna essentially elect who the police chief is, who's gonna sit on council, and you know, he runs the budget of the town, and it's gonna be the same thing. They set themselves back. What was that, 5-10 years? They set themselves back at least 5-10 years. No progress to be made. So now when you have to fight, you're going to have to fight even harder.
Ashe, you're absolutely right. Voter education and political education. See, I mean, and that goes back to the difference in what we're looking at now educationally and what we experienced in the past. We were a part of the conversations that impacted our lives. So therefore, we had political involvement on a family level in other generations more so than we have now. And I think that too many of us got comfortable, too many of us forgot, and not enough of us reached back and helped someone else up. So in changing how we are conversing with one another, we know that that's what has to happen in order for the right type of shift in our thinking or a paradigm shift to happen amongst our people. So how should we begin to have the right types of conversations in our community so that we can get to the point of being empowered with what we come across and the information that we learn?
I think that we're having the right conversation. I think the problem is that our people forget. In this age of information, with the advent of social media, information being readily available to us, it's like information overload. So we're getting so much information, people forgot about what happened yesterday. And I think that's what happened in Ferguson. You know, after a couple of years, the pain, the anger subsided, and people was no longer upset and frustrated. We can't no longer be like that. We have to continuously fight good fight. And another thing is, what should have been done is, leading up to that mayor's election, the same people that had that drive and that vigor when Mike Brown got killed should have been back out there in the street saying that this mayor cannot get in office. And we have to learn from our, you know, our civil rights leaders. You know, they brought about a lot of change. I don't agree with everything they did, but some of the stuff they did worked. And one of the things they used to do is they would have a carpool where they would knock on doors. Do you need a ride to go to the polls? They would get vans. They would pay for cabs. They would rent buses and take the whole neighborhood down there to go and vote. And I think if that they would have done that, because she only lost by 500 votes, then the turnout would have been totally different.
Wow. So do you think that they learned their lesson, or is it have people pretty much gone back to sleep? Because the entire world was watching what was happening in Ferguson.
Oh, no.
What I've learned from talking to people who don't live here is that they're wondering, you know, why folks haven't revolted way before now.
No, they didn't learn their lesson, because they learned their lesson. When you say learn their lesson, you talking in regards to the residents or the people in power?
Well, I'm speaking of the people, from the perspective of the people, especially considering what you just said about the election. Do you think that they...
They didn't learn their lesson, you know, because if they did, this mayor wouldn't be in office. But they're going to learn this time.
Yeah.
They're going to learn this time, because anytime, you know, an individual is put in a position of power and they know they don't even belong in that position, it starts to stroke their ego. He done already got elected. I don't know if he can do a third term. I don't know what the laws are in that particular state. But if he can, then he's going to do whatever he want to do, because he knows that the same people that voted for him this time is going to vote for him again. So, you know, sometimes we don't learn our lesson. And that's, you know, to be honest with you, that's a question that we just have to wait and see.
Ashe. We're going to take a quick break. We're almost to the top of the hour. You're listening to Sign of the Times, brought to you by New Power Radio Network. Our guest tonight is Raheem Shabazz. Dial in at 917-889-8059. If you're listening on your computer, if you're listening on your phone, feel free to push 1 after the break and we'll bring you in the queue. Thank you for listening. My name is Queen Tahira. We'll be right back.
Consciousness. Without human consciousness, there is no world. It is the presence of human consciousness that brings meaning into the world. Without human beings in this world, conscious human beings in this world, in effect, there would not be a world. We bring the world into being through our consciousness. And through our consciousness, we create the world we live in. Out of the totality of reality, our consciousness cuts out a world that befits itself. In other words, the kind of world you exist in reflects the kind of consciousness that you have. And notice, if you change your consciousness or change your values and orientation, you enter into a different world. You interact with different people. People often that you didn't even know existed in the world. Social situations that you might not have even recognized until you entered into a new level of consciousness. You see people, say, for instance, who become addicted, say, to crack or something. and now enter into a whole world and enter into a whole social system that before they became addicted, they hardly noticed. They didn't know what it was all about. And they picked up new friends and new relations, whole new ways of acting, whole new purposes in life. They lost old friends, broke with old families, all kinds of things. In other words, the consciousness, that addictive consciousness, brought into the world a new foreground and put other things into the background. Therefore, man's consciousness is a creative act. And the kind of consciousness you have will determine the kind of world you create. And consequently, when you look at the world that we live in, African people, we must recognize to a great extent it is a world of our own creation.
All right.
It is a world that has been generated by the type of consciousness we've been permitted to be instilled in us as a people.
Hey, my beautiful people, this is Andreanne, and I'm host of the show Holistic Health and Healing on the New Power Radio Network. We all know that without your help, nothing else is worthwhile, right? I mean, what's the point of being rich if you end up spending all the time you have left and all the money you've made on the way to get back the health that was neglected on the journey? Well, let's get back to making our health and well-being a priority. Then the wealth and prosperity will automatically flow. So join us as we dive into all matters of health and well-being holistically in all areas of your life. We'll discuss the causes and effects of diseases and medical conditions and what you can do to heal from these effects. You'll hear suggestions on how to best utilize the medical establishment for your benefit instead of their profit. We'll explore all of the latest innovations in health and well-being and how to apply them in all areas of your life. In the end, we must remove everything that's creating and maintaining the pain and disease in our lives in order to treat our wounds and to heal. Here's to your holistic health. Many blessings. Peace.
Welcome back to Sign of the Times, everyone. Welcome back, Brother Raheem.
I'm back.
Ashe, Ashe. That clip I played was Dr. Amos Wilson, and the beautiful doctor left us many of his literary works has to use, and one of them is Unlocking the Consciousness of the Black Child. So can you talk about that a little bit more? How can we begin to unlock the consciousness of our children and teach them that they are smart from the very beginning?
I think that you use a perfect analogy yourself when you played that clip from Baba Amos Wilson, and he does a beautiful job of that in many of his books, and one in particular is Blueprint to Power, Blueprint to Black Power. In order for us to unlock what Dr. Wilson called the multi-genius in our child is to start teaching them from early. And it's always proven that the earlier that a child learns, the better off they is. Right now, in 2017, young black males and females are starting kindergarten with less than 250-word vocabulary. That is not good. So you can't blame the school system when you're already starting them at a disadvantage. It's almost like a snowball effect. It gets worse from there. I recently read a study that said that students from poor economically disadvantaged neighborhoods are at a disadvantage when they start public school, and that their vocabulary is limited. That when they start kindergarten, that they are starting with 24 hours of reading. when you come from a middle class and you start kindergarten, that you have 1,700 hours of reading. So that's almost equivalent. you can see the disparity in that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to start teaching and reading to our kids at an early age. In their formative years, we know that that is the most important time of their life, and that's how we develop and mold their brain to become that multi-level genius that Baba Amos Wilson talks about.
Ashe. Let's talk about the composition of the classroom. And when it comes to our males and our female brothers and sisters, we're looking at who is teaching our children. It's mostly comprised of white females. And there is an echoing absence of black males, even when you look at even service positions. Black males are not really a part of our public school system. As we look at the fact that there is a lot of feminization of our boys going on and masculinization of our females going on, how much do you think that absence of the black male and overpresence of the white female may have to do with that?
It has a big effect. When you have young kids not seeing people that look like themselves, talk like them, and that have a genuine love for them and positions of power, then it does something to the psyche. One of the things that I learned from early on is that children do not learn from people that they don't like. And one thing about young kids, they have innate ability to be able to detect whether a teacher genuinely cares for them or a teacher genuinely likes them. And I say this to parents all the time. You have these white, predominantly female teachers that come into urban areas and want to teach. It's almost the same thing like what happened in Africa, you know, with the missionaries. When we was over there, we had the land, they had the Bible. They came in, they said, you know, put your head down and pray. People prayed, they woke up. They had the Bible, they had the land. You got to be careful of individuals that will always want to come in and be helpful, and they call themselves allies. And, you know, if a white person will not send their son or their daughter to that school, then they shouldn't be teaching there, you know. Mm-hmm. And just it probably needs to be a residency clause. If you don't live in a community or within a certain mile or radius, then you're not allowed to teach in there. The teacher should come from within the community, and that's how it used to be, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, the teachers was a part of the community. And I think that it needs to get back to that, because the teacher that's in there now, what is happening, what is it, Teach for America, or Teachers of America, they have a 6-year course.
Mm-hmm.
And you qualify to go into schools, and most of the times they put you in schools that no one want to teach in, and they're not relatively prepared for it. They haven't been around black folks. They don't understand our culture, and, you know, they're culturally biased to how we live, our language of talking. And so there's always going to be a disconnect. But one thing I will say, because a lot of people is like, oh, so you need to tell me the white person can teach a black child? And I'm not saying that. You know, I had a white teacher that really piqued my interest into reading when she gave me the book Man, Child, and the Promised Land by Chloe McKay. That sent me off to to wanting to read everything from James Baldwin to Nikki Giovanni, and the list goes on and on. But that was one person that I encountered my whole entire life, you know. So we don't have time to wait another 60 years till a John Brown come along, you know. I appreciate the work that she did, you know, and she knew that in order to get our attention, because she didn't have, you know, nobody else could get our attention, she got something that resonated with us. A book that when I read and I was reading about certain characters, it resonated with me because these was black folks. She didn't give me Dr. Seuss books, you know. She didn't give me any books, Huckleberry Finn, or none of those books. She gave me what I, you know, what she felt I needed, and it worked.
Wow, Ashe, that's important to surround our children with that type of environment that is reflective of us. Go on, Ashe. Now, in Elementary Genocide 3, Academic Holocaust, talk about some of the people who are involved in that project and what did you say to them to get them to commit?
The individuals that are involved in the project are Dr. Boyce Watkins. We have him in there. We have rapper activist David Banner. We also have Professor Ed Gons. We have a sister named Sister Amina. Let me see, who else? We have Kaba Kenny. Many of y'all might be familiar with him. He was in Hidden Colors 1 through 4. We also have Professor James Small. He was in Hidden Colors 1 through 4. And we have a lot of other individuals that you probably going to have to watch the documentary to see. I don't remember everybody on top of the head. And then we also have myself. And speaking of that documentary, right now we have an Indiegogo campaign that you can go to Indiegogo.com and put Elementary Genocide 3 in the search engine. And if you can, we ask that you contribute, because we are not independently financed by anybody. We don't take corporate money. And in order for us to deliver the unadulterated truth, we need the support of our people. This is our third time around. This documentary is going to definitely be impactful. We did it twice on our own, and now we are asking for individuals to help. You can go online. We have a trailer. You can watch the trailer to it. It's the first look trailer. It's not the official trailer, but it's the first look trailer. And we, you can also go to elementarygenocide.com. You can view that. You can also watch the two previous trailers, Elementary Genocide 1, Elementary Genocide 2. And you can also order it on there. And a lot of people I know are saying, oh, do you have it in DVD format? No, you can actually go on Amazon and stream it live from any mobile device, from your iPhone, your iPad, your cell phone. So you can do that. And we're getting ready to start offering downloads, where you can just download it to your computer and open it in your preferred web browser.
Ashe, give your website out again so people can write that down.
Say it again.
Give your website.
Hello.
Give your website again.
Elementarygenocide.com. And if you want to contribute to the campaign, you can go to Indiegogo and put the word Elementary Genocide 3 search engine.
Okay. Now, let's talk about the documentary, Elementary Genocide 3, Academic Holocaust. Talk a little bit about the title and where that title came from. How did you move to this phase?
Academic Holocaust is just, I think I explained it a little earlier. I'll go back into it. It's essentially the assassination of your critical thinking, and that's being done with the miseducation in the school system. That's being done when you have individuals that are teaching that are culturally biased and that don't come from the community of the students. That's academic Holocaust. The Holocaust happens when an individual is ill-educated and have to go and function in society, and the education that he is taught is only good for him to be a consumer and not a provider or a producer. It's almost like you're killing yourself off. And then when you put in subservient positions and you don't have power economically, politically, then it's easy for the police to come into our communities and murder us with impunity. So not only we deal with what's going on in the public school system, we also deal with how this psychologically affects what's going on around the world and what we see on the news today.
Ashe, I want to remind those that are listening on your phone as we get ready to wrap up, if you'd like to come into queue, please push 1. So, Brother Raheem, you know, looking at the work that needs to be done and hearing that this is an actual movement again that is going to go way beyond the documentary series and move into the streets, one of the things that we know is it's sometimes hard to do is to resolve conflict. And so in turning this struggle into a strategy, how do you anticipate us being able to move past any sort of conflict that we may have as we continue to grow and unite?
Well, when you talk about moving beyond any conflict, I'm assuming you're talking amongst ourselves as melanated
amongst
people,
us,
correct?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Exactly.
What we have to do, the number one thing is we have to put aside our petty differences. One of the things that Marcus Garvey said is that we are a race that's cursed by petty differences. And once we get beside that and we unite, then we'll be a powerful force. We have to do that. And then another thing is that there is going to come a time where you're going to have a gripe with your brother or a gripe with your sister. It's human nature. We're social beings. We interact on different levels. That's going to happen. But let it happen behind. Everything ain't good for social media. You know, we have to stop every minute. You know, people are airing out their dirty laundry on social media. We have to resolve our conflicts behind closed doors. And speaking about behind closed doors, you know, there's a lot of things that I'm involved in, certain things that I do that people have no idea of, because there's a rule. When we walk into this building, we walk beyond this door, everybody's phone is off. We're not tweeting about it. We never was here, and this conversation can't be recorded. We have to start getting to that. Everything ain't for the media. Everything ain't for social media. And that's another thing. Like we will get on social media and plan a protest or plan our next call to action. And then when you show up and it's police and barricades and you wonder why they there, you put it on social media. You know,
yeah.
So we have to be more smart. We have to be more strategic. And we got to outthink them. And we can do it, you know, because they're not the sharpest knife in the drawer. But it's mistakes that we make that put them in positions that they are in. So we got to start thinking more strategically.
I was just going to get ready to close out now because it sounds like you have a cold too, Liz, so I want to be respectful of you, and I know that you've been traveling. I agree with you, Brother Raheem.
No, it's not that. We can go on a little longer. But yeah, I do have a cold. I've been traveling. And, you know, it happened. I'm here.
Yes.
So, you know, we can definitely go on. Another thing I wanted to say, I want to put out there for those that are interested in reaching me via social media. I'm on Twitter. I'm on Facebook. I'm on Instagram. I'm on virtually every social media platform, and my handle is at Raheem Shabazz, so you can just hit me up there.
Ashe, Ashe. I also want to ask you this, Brother Raheem. I know because I tutored for years in the public school system, teaching kindergartners in first grade how to read, I know that the miseducation of our children begins very early on. And so as we look at developing programs, how many how long do you think it will be before we actually begin to see a real shift in our children? Do you think that it'll take an entire generation, or do you think that it depends on how well we use the fact that we have access to the internet and information at our fingertips? What is your vision as far as that goes, and you know, where are we headed, in your opinion, as a group of people?
Oh, as I'm seeing tangible results, oh, I see it now. I see it every day because I follow movement. Most people don't mm-hmm. see it because it's not going to be on mainstream news. There is a brother out of Chicago named Marcus Klein, and you can Google him, and he has Freedom Home Academy. You Google that school and you watch those videos of those young African warriors, and you'll see what homeschooling or Afrocentric curriculum can do. They're also opening one here in Atlanta that'll be directed by a brother named Kalonji Chenga. So it's being done. And it's a lot of schools, a lot of different organizations and programs that is being done, but it needs to be more. It needs to be more. 85% of students need to be enrolled in an Afrocentric school. That's when you're going to start seeing results on a massive scale. Right now, you see it. Most of the people don't see it, but I see it every day. You know, I live in a predominantly black community, so I see it up front and personal.
Ashe. So as we look at, you know, another one of the situations that exists in the current public school system is the doping of our children, getting behavior modification actions taken that often end up with our children being medicated. Can you talk about that, and have you found that, is there a difference in the number of black males that are medicated versus black females? Do they have a tendency to medicate more one over the other, and what can we do to resolve that?
Well, one of the things that we can do is stop giving them permission. That's the first thing. You know, we complain about what's going on in the situation, but in order for any child to be put on any psychotropic medication, the parents had to give permission. That's rule number one. There's a book by Dr. Umar Johnson that deals extensively in that. Also in Elementary Genocide 1, he talks extensively about that. So I implore everybody to get the DVD or watch the DVD, and there's a lot of factual information as far as data and different things like that. And I think that it's a disservice that kids will be given these medications that are on the same level as cocaine and opium, and the adverse effect that it has on them and down the line, what it can do to them. And there was a time, you know, in my father and grandparents' time, there was no medication. You know, you don't medicate someone in order for them to behave. You can't medicate anyone to get them to learn. And then also, the main thing is that these doctors and the psychiatrists, you cannot scientifically prove that someone has any type of behavior or mental disorder. It's all based on opinion. So when you go to them white doctors, you're getting an opinion of what he thinks of your child. Nothing scientific about it. And they will tell you that. They cannot say they will tell you that none of this is scientific, in my opinion. You know, and parents give them permission. It's almost like a racketeer where the school gets a certain amount of money allotted to them for having kids that's on medication or ADHD. And the reason why ADHD and special education started because no longer was it permissionable for them to segregate students. So in order to get the classroom size down where it's not that many blacks or that there's more whites in the classroom or in a particular school is to put them in special education program. That's how they segregate the classes because they don't, essentially, they don't want their kids learning with your kids anyway. But there's a lot more to that. You have to go watch the documentary.
I will. Now, remind the listeners
about the whole documentary.
No, we're going to actually have a showing here in Cincinnati of one and two and then get ready for three. So give out your contact information again and let the listeners know how they can pick up Elementary Genocide.
Anybody interested in getting Elementary Genocide can go directly to the website. It's elementarygenocide.com. You can get one and two. Actually, if you get both of them, there's no shipping and handling. You also can get it on Amazon. You also can stream it on Amazon. You can download it on Amazon. You just put in Elementary Genocide in the search engine. And once again, family, I implore everybody to contribute to our solution by going to Indiegogo.com. Put an Elementary Genocide 3 in the search engine and contribute to our cause. We have approximately 6 days, I think, left on our campaign.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, you heard it here first, everybody. Please, 6 days left during the campaign. So how close are you, Brother Raheem?
Not close. Not at all.
Okay.
And
okay.
The money that we raised, I can't even get my clothes out of cleaners with that type of money. I'm just going to be honest. And
okay.
But every dollar helps. And what I will say is that I always put up my money to do it. It's just that in this situation, I thought I could get, with crowdfunding. Everyone's doing crowdfunding. And when you get a movie done, there's a lot of things that has to be done. You have to have promotion budget in line. You have to, traveling expense to go around screening it. A lot of it's so much that is involved in it. So I wanted to be able to, cover all grounds because there's certain things that we wasn't able to do with two that we wanted to do. It was certain things that we couldn't do with one, but we was able to do it with two. So it was certain things that I wanted to do with three, and you always want to boost the production value of it. But nevertheless, the documents you still get done, I just got to dig into the savings, because this is what I
That's
do.
Right.
I got a passion for it. The message is there. We come too far right now to turn back. So regardless of whom or what, I'm going to do everything within my power to make sure this documentary come out. It will be out on time. I just got someone asking me the question today. What day are you going to have it released? I would never, ever give a specific day because what can go wrong will go wrong. And one thing you don't like to do is you don't like to rush creativity. Because if I tell you that it'll be done May 5th, May 5th, everybody's going to be calling me. You said it was going to be done. And it might be something that I looked at. I want to go back and change. I want to enhance it a little bit. So, this takes time. This is not no mixtape. A lot of people think this is like a mixtape. Every year I can put out a documentary. And I almost was at the point of doing that, like every year dropping a project, but it's too overwhelming because I have other things going on, you know. It's not my bread and butter, you know. So I have other things going on where I'm able to take some of that money that I make from there and put it into these documentaries.
I
think I'm at 13% of each of my goals. So we, you know, we already figured it out that, you know, what, regardless of whatever we raise, that we're still going to be able to deliver, make it impactful.
I've got one last question, if you don't mind. I have a brother that's listening.
I don't know if you hear it. I got like four people buzzing in my line. So one of them, I have to take their call. They're going to call me right back. But let's go, because I told them I was going to be doing an interview.
This is the last one, I promise.
Okay.
I promise. This is the last one. There's a brother listening who is just now getting involved in community work here in Cincinnati. He has a function coming up on Saturday. Entitled Black Empowerment Lecture and Presentation. And Q Butter is coming down from New York to help support him. And he's new at this. And so what can you say to him to help him as he begins this process, and that he doesn't get discouraged and that he stays positive, throughout? They're dealing with everything from building credit to building development to building black schools and supporting black businesses. All the things that we've talked about need to be addressed. So what advice do you have him as a young brother that's just now getting involved in this arena? And then I'm going to let you go.
Okay, shout out to Q Butter. I'm familiar with him, and shout out to that young brother that, you know, stepping to the forefront and ready to fight for the liberation of our people. I think that is a noble thing that he's doing. Let me start by saying that, because we know that there will never be a riot in a community with average credit score is 700. So when we're dealing with economic inequalities, we see the results of that, and it's always going to be a riot. So we do need to clean up our credit, and I'm all for that. So salute to that brother for teaching those courses and those classes. Any advice that I will give him, I would just say that you have to go out to the community and talk and reach the people. You know, a lot of people initially starting out, they want to get on Facebook and different things like that. And I see a lot of people put together events, and it doesn't be a success because all they did was Facebook promotion. We got to do it old school. You have to get physical flyers. You have to go to different events and put them in people's hands. Go out, talk to them, touch the people. They might have ask questions. You can answer some of the questions right on the spot. And then after the second question, say, you gotta come to the seminar. You should know about that.
That's right.
You know, so there's different ways of doing it, of reaching people. I'm not saying don't use Facebook, but Facebook, it's almost like, you know, people are coming, you know, Facebook revolutionaries, the armchair revolutionaries. That's what they used to call them back in the day. You got to step behind that computer and get out here and do the work. And I think that's what the brother is doing already. So, you know, salute to him. And,
yeah.
I think, you know, his event, you know, it will go off without a hitch. The first time, you know, you might get a couple of people, and that's good. You know, a lot of times if you start off big, you can get 300 people in the room. If you're going to have a continuous program or a seminar, in 6 months you might be down to only 30 or 60 people. So don't look at the numbers. That's the main thing. Don't, you know, and see, that's the white man thinking too. They always, if you can't count it or quantify it, then it don't exist. We got to get away from that. If you got 10 brothers and 10 sisters in a room, that's a corporation right there. You can start with just that. You don't need a lot of people. You know, especially when you're doing like a seminar, you want it to be up close and personal. So don't really get caught up in all the numbers.
That's right. That's right. Well, I know he's listening, and I know he appreciates your unity. And hopefully one day we'll get you to come to Cincinnati and bless us with your presence and share some of that energy that you have, because we definitely need it here. And so as we get ready to close, thank you, Brother Raheem. We appreciate you. And
thank
feel
you.
Free to post any information that you have as far as the promotion. I'm going to go look for your link, too, so if you can send it to me, then I can help get the word out as much as I can on my end to any potential supporters. I'd be more than happy to do that for you.
I will do. I will do. And, yes, I definitely need to get up there to Cincinnati. I've been to Ohio. In fact, I came up here twice. I've been to Mansfield. You familiar with Mansfield, Ohio?
Yes, yes, very familiar.
Yeah, yeah, that's where they got that prison at. Everybody knows Mansfield
yeah.
from that prison. But, yeah, I've been up there. I got a lot of good people up there. I've been to Cincinnati for a day. We hung out, but I definitely need to come back and do a screening up there.
Yeah, for sure, for
all
sure.
Right.
And I'm telling you, I think it would go very well. Thank you very much for being a part of the conversation tonight. Feel free to come back anytime you like. We'll be here tomorrow, p.m. Eastern Standard Time, with Dr. James Jones out of Prairie View University. Hot Topics is our business tomorrow night, so we'll see you then. This is Queen Tahira signing off. Thank you, everybody. Salute.
Brother, call a girl a bitch or a hoe. Trying to make a sister feel low. You know all of that got to go. Now everybody knows there's exceptions to this rule. I don't be getting mad when we playing, it's cool. But don't you be calling me out my name. I bring crap to those who disrespect me like a dame. That's why I'm talking. One day I was walking down a block. I had my cut off shorts on right because it was crazy hot. I walked past these dudes when they passed me. One of them felt my booty, he was nasty.
Yeah.
I turned around red, somebody was catching the rat. Then the little one said,
yeah, me, bitch.
And laughed. Since he was with his boys, he tried to break fly. I punched him dead in his eyes.
Who you calling
a bitch? People out there with triggers ready to pull it while you trying to jump in front of the bullet. Young lady.